That's the first thing. Secondly, to introduce Steve Mills, who, just to say quickly how we know Steve, I mean, as you know, some of us play football, cricket, basketball or netball for the Eastern Cowboys Sports Club, which is based in the Plough in Eastern. And over the years, I've kind of met Steve in there, and I think his team at the time at Anstey's Bakery. And I've just been informed they put three past our second team a few years ago, and Steve banged one past our keeper. But anyway, so that's kind of how we know Steve.
You're holding against me now,
aren't you? Holding against him, you know. Sure, it was offside or something. But anyway, that's how we kind of first met Steve. And I also know Steve because I'm a West Ham United fan, and Steve is obviously a hammer as well. So we're part of the West Ham Supporters Club in Bristol, the Bristol Hammers. Basically. So that's kind of how we know each other. And it was only a few years ago we were chatting, and I kind of discovered that Steve's a bit of a historian. He said to me, well, I don't talk about history much, he said, but when I hear, I think the quote was bullshit being talked, then I will intervene. So obviously here's stuff that he didn't really agree with, he'd intervene as a historian. So Steve did a talk in 2006 for us at the first Radical History Week, and about the Kingswood Colliers, and we're really pleased to have him back today to talk about Kingswood and the Commons.
Thank you very much indeed, Roger. Thank you. And an honour to be here. Thank you very much. I thought the warm-up acts were very good, didn't you? Right, today I'm going to speak to you about three things. They're all interlinked. I'm going to talk to you about the customary common rights, what were the commons, how they exercised and such likes. I'm then going to go on a bit about the one-day house, which some of you might have heard of before, which is also a customary right. And I'm going to do a little bit about local history, because as Roger said, I'm very, very interested in the Kingswood Colliers, the miners up there, and what led on to the Cock Road Gang, and what really turned out to eventually in the 1870s to be a little mini insurrection up there, which ended up in the closure of large amounts of land and the intervention of the poor law, which was very sad. But first off, what was commons? Well, first I'm going to big up two books, actually, because I was going to do a reading list, but I just didn't have the time. But I would like to mention this book, Cotter's Squatters, by Colin Wall. Some of the anarchists amongst us might have heard about him before. He writes for the Housing Review and such like. It's extremely interesting. I've got a lot of stuff about the one-day house. What I intend to do is later interact with Roger and get some of this put on the internet site. This is another one, Neeson, Commoners, and this is a lot about the rights and such likes. Now, common, basically, as you're aware, we've increased in population significantly, but in the good old days of the 16th and 17th century, there was a lot of land that just wasn't basically used very much by the landowners. You might have had arable lands that the large landowners would pasture with their cows, or perhaps used for wheat or barley or for fodder for the animals, but there was also large amounts of wastelands. And it's funny that they called it wasteland because it certainly wasn't left to waste. Large amounts of people, in fact the vast majority of the population, would use it for one reason or another. And I'm actually going to read a little bit out of Neeson's book from the index, just to give you a rough idea of some of the uses of common lands. For example, off common land you get acorns. Now acorns would be really good for grazing for pigs, for your pigs. Ash, beechmark, beanstakes, berries, birds and the eggs. Bracken, brambles, browse, brushwood, chalk, clay for making pots and such likes. Down, flags, fish, flowers, furs. Furs is very interesting, you know, that stuff that when you go walking in Wales scratches your ankles up. Very, very useful for fires. You get a really bright flame, really get heat very quickly, but it was also used for lime kilns, for pottery, for stuff like that, and also in the brewing industry, actually. It was very useful for that. You get a really sharp hot flame. Fowling, gleaning, gravel, hazel. Hazel was really used for making hurdles and fences and stuff like that. Nettle soup, nuts, mushrooms, peas, rabbits, reeds, rushes, salads, sawdust. I could go on and go on and go on. Basically, the point is, the common land was essential for a large amount of the population for their upkeep. And basically, you'd have people, you'd have landless commoners who perhaps are rented off the landlords, but had rights of common, could go along and collect dead wood, which obviously during winter would be absolutely essential to keep them alive. They could use it for repairing their buildings. They could collect food, nuts and berries to keep their kids alive and such like through periods of dearth. And also sometimes, most importantly, they were allowed to put a certain amount of their livestock on the commons, and they were allowed to graze on there. Now, also, there was also an element of bartering and trade going on, because, I mean, you'd have people that would actually have trades that are condensed on the common, like I just spoke about hazels and hurdle makers. You'd also have people who made wheels, so they collect a certain type of wood that then they would work back at their cottages and either sell or more likely swap for somebody else who collects a load of furs for their fire, for example. A man called Reverend Linney listed some of these trades: tree fellers and shearers, sawyers and hurdlers, spoke choppers, faggoteers, lath renders, rake and ladder makers. And he also says that forest food, and he's speaking about Northamptonshire, could feed a whole family all the way through the year. Basically, it was sustainability as well, which is very, very important. The actual laws, which I'm going to get onto in a minute, customary laws of the commons, were handed down through generations. But so was the use of the common, because it was everybody's. So you wouldn't want somebody overusing it. They knew the seasons, they knew when to take the bird eggs, they knew when it was a good idea to cut down the new saplings and when to leave the saplings, how many to cut down, how many not to cut down. Now, how was this actually policed, if you like? Well, it depends who actually owned the wider lands. Most of the time it was manorial or vestry courts. So we heard Dan earlier talking about monasteries holding great big swathes of land. Sometimes disputes would be heard at the vestry court, for example, or at the manorial court where the lord of the manor would hear disputes. But also, a lot of the time, it would be sorted out amongst the people. The people would have a word with it, you know, and make sure that the common was sustained, kept up to scratch, and was used for everybody. And this is especially important with overstocking, perhaps. You know, when if somebody, they had a certain rights to a certain amount of livestock on a certain area sometimes of the common, and if they overstocked it, they would be told to reduce the amount of livestock they put on that particular piece of common. Now, there's also different rights that come with it. For example, you might actually buy a cottage that would have a garden, but also would have a customary right that had been handed down over generations for use of the common. You might have, within the lease or within the deeds, it would say that you had rights for 3 pigs, 10 cows, and so many chickens. Excuse me. And that was upheld in law, and if you were found to be overstocking the commons, you'd be held accountable, and maybe even lose your rights. Commons also, I mean, I suppose most of you round here know Oldland Common, which is about one of the last vestiges we have of common lands. And there's no fences, it's just open land, isn't it? You know, you've got all sorts of different uses that I've just spoken about. But also common land, sometimes you might be allowed to fence a piece off. Yeah, and this is where it starts to get dodgy later, with rights and exercising those rights as well. Because, on the whole, common right was customary. It was word of mouth. And this is why it became very difficult later, especially for landless labourers, to exercise their rights during enclosure acts, because nothing was written down. And the law needed, or they said they needed, to see things written down so people could retain those rights that they'd have had for generations. Now, I expect most of the people sat in front of us, or with us today, your ancestors would have had some sort of common right. It was only that even the large landowners would exercise some sort of common right at times. You know, they would also exercise the right of livestock and such like. In fact, sometimes, pre-enclosure act, to force a lot of people on, they would actually overstock it themselves. Because if you had the retort back to law by the manorial court, and they were the chair of that court, there wasn't a lot you could do about it if they ran all their cows on there and ate all the fodder. But the cottages, there's two different types of cottages. I did say earlier I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the one-day house. There was the cottages that was actually built as on the outsides of the common that had the common rights. They would be copyholds, freeholds, there would be legal deeds to these, whether it would be on a 99-year lease or something like that. But there was also the one-day house, which was a squatted structure. Now this is a worldwide thing. I've been through Ward and Heat and a lot of other sources, and we cannot find where this actually stems from. It's just a bit of oral custom. You still see it in parts of India and Latin America. Basically, the one-day house, and there's lots of different variations across the world, but the one that you see in Kingswood and in Wales and in parts of Scotland basically is around building a structure with four walls between dusk and dawn and having smoke coming from the hearth or a pot boiling on the fire. If you have that, and the manorial courts, the ranger or the warden or whoever was meant, the reeve, whoever was ever meant to be overseeing the use of the common, was satisfied, you could squat that piece of land. Now, as I said, there's different variations. And also, it does lead to some dispute as well. When you think about it, how many people and how long would it really take you to build a stone structure? I used to be a bricky many moons ago, at least that's why I told them I was collecting my wages. And I know that if you build a wall up too high, it will start to bulge. Admittedly, they probably wouldn't have used the same sort of blue circle cement as we did, and they probably had better or at least differing building techniques. But all the same, it would have taken a long time to build that structure. What would normally happen would they would build a semi-stable structure of wood gained from the common, from turf also gained from the common, and sometimes mix up a mixture of sand, soil, clay, stone, straw. I've even had one in Ottery-sur-Mer where they were very specific about bollock hair. Why bollock hair? I don't know. And I'm sure they mean the bovine rather than a lot of hairy mates. But like, and they'd make the structure, and then they'd get it. I mean, literally, I mean, it would be a very small structure. About where I'm stood now, you know, about 10 foot by 20 foot, about 4 or 5 foot high, with a roof on it, with the smoke coming out. But once they had that right, that didn't stop them improving and building on it as well. So basically what would normally happen was you do one wall 1 week, you do another wall another week, etc, etc, etc. But the one thing about the one house that I really like is the essence of community. There's no way that a single person could have put that up. They might have had a larger family that helps them, but also there would have to be some commoners, I would suggest, that help them. And going back to Ottery-St. Mary, there's definite evidence that's written down that if people are aggrieved against the building of this squatter's cottage, that they can actually go down while they're building and rip it down. So therefore, you know, you would have a conflict, so that I suppose the majority would win in the end. Other things about rights, I mean, as I said, the rights are different than on different parts of the world. Up in Scotland, some parts of Scotland, for example, if the roof was on, it has to be rained on. Now, what happens if you want to build it during the summer? And I would suggest you would want to build one during the summer rather than mucking about in the rain. Well, what they did is actually poured water over it. I mean, all it was, the actual law was actually seeing that the actual roof was strong enough to sustain something like that, as opposed to the rain. Another bylaw was said that you had to have a kip in there. That you had to have a little sleep before the hours of dawn. So basically you had to build this structure, get into bed, have a kip. Who would chest that out? You can picture. Are you asleep? No. other those stories, like, and there was one in Troon, in Cornwall, I believe, Troon, isn't it? And another one in Italy as well, where the actual process took a period of months. Because another thing you have to think about is, well, the land would have to be cleared. I mean, the commons, you know, there's all sorts of land usage. And to actually get something of the size I've just spoken about, you have to clear the land. So if you start clearing the land, someone's going to think something's going on here. But getting back to Troon, this one individual knew what he wanted, knew where he wanted to build, and actually got the stone together over the period of time. Nearly a year it took him. In Italy, the evidence that I found was there was a bloke who was about to get married and he wanted to build this cottage. And he was already a coal miner, and he'd found this new seam and got a reward from the colliery owner, and he used that to buy the stone. Then he got all his mates together, built the cottage, and had rights. There's also other things about it, about the poor law. very important. There's evidence in vestry records, for example, where somebody went up and said, look, I've got nowhere to live, I've got these 14 kids, I'm going to build this structure here, any problems? And basically a blind eye was turned. The structure was built. He had common rights, the father, because the mother had died. That was another thing about it. She died in childbirth on the 14th child, and she was probably knackered after that anyway. And the kids were not reliant on the poor law, because he had all the common rights as well. I mean, you would sort with 14 kids as well, really. After 10, they're going to be working on the commons anyway, because there's lots of different little jobs they could do. You could send a little one off, for example, collecting berries, a bit older, up the tree getting birds' eggs. The older ones would actually be doing more physical work and perhaps even learning a trade, apprenticeship or something like that. Yeah? Land. This is a very interesting one, because sometimes it actually came with a little enclosed garden, like an allotment. And that wasn't clear how that was sorted out, but my favourite story is in Wales, where once the cottage was built, the owner of the squatted cottage would stand with his back, and it was normally the him, his back to the wall, and throw an axe. And as far as the axe went, was where his boundary would be for his actually enclosed garden. Once again, you could picture the warden coming up to check on this cottage, and there's a geezer there throwing an axe about. You're going to let him get on with it, ain't you? You are, though. So, these cottages, and I'm now going to talk a little bit about Kingswood. As I said, they had the common rights, and in the 1600s, early 1600s in Kingswood, a lot of these cottages were starting to go up. But not only were they starting to go up, but they were also having the rights of coal mining. Now this, as I'm sure you're aware, was a very, very, very dangerous job in those days. So basically you'd have a cottage and you'd have a right to sink a hole. And it was literally that. And the miners, I mean, normally it was family concerns, so you can imagine, can't you, a few cottages in close proximity with quite a large hole in the middle, where literally you were lowered down a piece of rope with your packed lunch and some sort of lighting and a pickaxe to go and do your day's work. You were lowered down the bottom, you chipped it out, and you had the right to sell that coal. Now what actually happened in Kingswood is during the Civil War, and even after Restoration, far more of these cottages started to go up. Now I suspect you've all heard of William the Conqueror. Now when he came over, he had the bright idea that all the forests were going to be crown property, so he could go hunting in it. And he tried to police this, didn't do very well. Some of the forests were well policed, but Kingswood not particularly. He did pop up now and again, as did some of his people who came, the kings that came after him, did a bit of hunting, a couple of days, then stayed in the lodge, then went back. But the Kingswood Forest was largely decimated for two reasons. One was the coal mining I've just spoken about, and the other one was shipbuilding. Now what happened here, because there was a lack of royal authority, there was more and more squatting, and also there was larger squatters as well, and the forest ended up being divided into four liberties. Now once again, when I was talking about the customary rights and it not being written down, where these four landowners actually got their liberties from, other than just strength of muscle, I'm unsure. But the forest was certainly split up into four areas that these major landowners felt that they had rights over. Now in the 1670s, a man called Throgmorton was sent down by Charles II after the Restoration, and was told to go and restore a bit of order. He obviously didn't read the small print in the job description, because he was on a loser. You had well-settled forest communities. And also, if you read the history before this as well, forest communities, I mean, post-Robin Hood, we all heard about Robin Hood. We've also heard about outlaws, deserters, waifs and strays making their way to the forest. The forest community was far more set aside, if you like, from the other commons, the waste commons, the fens and such like, the forest you could hide up there. And certainly this was the case in Kingswood. The first records I found down at the Bristol Records Office from spotting, right, so that back to 1585. But it certainly took off during the Civil War. One would hope, you have this romantic view, don't you? I haven't actually got the evidence for this, but I suppose most of you know that at the end of the English Civil War, when we locked Charlie's head off, and most of the army, New Model Army, hadn't been paid, so there was a Putney debates and such likes. What was the outcome of the revolution? We all know what happened from there. Unfortunately, a lot of the soldiers were brought off by land in Ireland, and they were actually shipped, a lot of them, from Bristol before the siege of Drogba. It's a history. It might be a sad part of our history, but it's there. There was also certainly deserters, and I feel that some of them ended up at Kingswood Forest. It would make sense, wouldn't it? If you're on the run, it's one of the main roads from Bristol to Bath. There's this big community already up there. So anyway, in 1670, Throgmorton comes along to restore order. And the first thing he does, and I love this is brilliant, he decides to restock the forest with deer, as if that's going to stop it. So he gets 10 bucks, 10 does, and off they go. So Barbie goes trotting, and 2 weeks later, they've all disappeared, haven't they? They probably all fell down holes, honestly, Governor. More than likely, ended up in a pot with carrots and peas. But they all disappeared, you know. Then he started trying to do sweeps of the area for guns, nets and snares, which suggests poaching is going on, you know. Might have been a bit wiser to do that before he let the deer out, but that's another story. So off he goes, and he's met with mass resistance. All his stewards are run off the land, and they're quite firmly told, no, you're not coming here. We've got customary rights to this. This is our land, and we can basically do what we want. And one of the things I particularly like about the Kingswood colliers, I suppose most of you in this room have heard about E.P. Thompson's moral economy, collective bargaining by right and such likes. All the Kingswood colliers, well, the Kingswood forest dwellers wanted, really, was to be left alone. And the other thing was really about the price of bread. They did write later about the toll roads that came into Bristol. I spoke about that in my last speech, and I'll go on a little bit more about that if you wish later. And that was basically about their actual rights to bring coal into Bristol, because they felt it was unfair, and they won this by riot, by collective bargaining by riot, that they should be charged to bring the coal that sustains Bristol, sustains the industry, as well as the heating in most of the houses. And they didn't think it was fair they were charged for that. So anyway, Throckmorton, completely unsuccessful, and 35 rioters were indicted. Not a single one of them was hung. This was before the Black Act, 1723 Black Act, which was brought about by Walpole, and that was George I, wasn't it, to counteract forest life once again, because down in Epping Forest and Waltham Forest, just outside of London, there was a hell of a lot of poaching, similar things to this, where the Crown was trying to re-exert its authority. And we heard earlier, didn't we, from Roger, about Ned Ludd and having a leader, if you like. They wanted a leader. And there were certain people down there, and some of them felt it was large landowners. And they were blacking their faces up and going out at night and taking the deer, knocking down the enclosure fences and such like. And that's why the Black Act came from. And in the Black Act, that is the single most, the act that brings about the most capital punishments in one go. You could get hung for a whole host of things all of a sudden. Things that normally you would take for granted. You know, if a little bunny rabbit comes bouncing across your front lawn, sorry, but you're going to have him, and he's in the pot. After Black Act, even if it's on your own land and it's eating your lettuces in your garden, they could hang you for it. So, but anyway, there was other riots throughout September. Now, Throgmorton wasn't as daft as he possibly looks historically, because he sold the lease in 1970. But this is the good bit as well. Guess where he ended up? Guess where he went next? Forest of Dean. 1674, tried exactly the same thing. Exactly the same outcome. Rumours has it was one of the first members in the Resource and Activity Centre for Learning Difficulties. But he sold his lease to Creswick, who tried to do the same sort of thing. Once again, what he did is he actually listed the squatters. Now, remember I spoke about the liberties and the four liberties? Now, see, these the four larger landowners, and I use owners loosely, saw the writing on the wall. That if the little people were knocked off their perch, if you like, then it wouldn't be long until their customary rights would also be challenged. So basically what they did, and this is something that happens throughout common law, and also with the one-day house as well, rather than pulling the house down, what they actually do is take the owner to a manorial court and fine them, a nominal fine. But then that fine becomes rent, and you pay it every year. So therefore, you do start to get some rights. But that's interesting as well, because rather than actually being some sort of... Well, sometimes it did move into a copyhold, but on the whole, it stayed on the manorial books as an actual fine. So therefore, once again, as I said, if enclosure came in later, your rights were limited. But some of these liberty holders, this is what they did. And Dawn Dyer, my favourite librarian, an Ellicombe manuscript, which is held in the library, very, very old. He was a vicar from the 19th century who got together a lot of documents and basically pasted them in. So it's like a scrapbook. Some of it's in Latin, some of it's all worn round the sides and such like. But what he has stuck in there is a little handbook with all the list of all the squatters, their acreage, and how long they've been there. And then later, another document is how much some of them are paying for rent, or what they were fined. And therefore, when the rights continued, also some of these larger landowners helped out the smaller people. Also, what happened here as well is a master collier would be designated, and there was a start to bring together some of the smaller pits into larger concerns, if you like, normally held on families. Now, the squatters, I'm not going to read out their names, but I tell you, because I had a bright idea when I first started this out, of having a look in the Kingswood phone book to see if there was anybody still hanging about, any residue from some of these families, and I'll tell you, they're all still there in their underwoods. The Stones, the Britons, I mean, we all know Britons and Bristol, don't we? You know, these people, these families have gone through generation and generation and generation of forest dwelling. But in 1675, there was listed 500 cottages, and Kingswood Forest was only 3,472 acres. So 500 cottages. With the mines, there was nearly 1,000 mines, and when we say 1,000, even though there's more mines than actual cottages, don't forget some of these to be whole sunk in the ground that perhaps were unsuccessful. It was very dangerous up there, especially at night, because there was literally holes everywhere. You know, people are sunk, no joy, move on to the next one. Or there is joy. And in 1583, Sir Ashby of Henbury, what's he got to do with it, you wonder? Well, basically, he says he exercises a warrant because local justice of the peace wouldn't do anything. They wouldn't do anything because everybody worked together. The forest worked. There was no need for outside interference. And getting back to the coal, you know, the way the colliers felt about it, and even more so in the early 19th century, you know, they were sustaining most of Bristol's industry. Prior to this, we got most of our coal from Newcastle. Newcastle was still possibly the nearest large coal scene. And it would come down by barge, by boat, down on the coast into Bristol Port. Here, it's a couple of miles down, without Lawford's Gate, was what was known as Kingswood Forest then, and there would be cart horse after cart horse after cart horse coming in, sustaining the needs of Bristolians. So really, there was quite a bit of sympathy in Bristol for them as well. Leave them alone, basically. So anyway, he did the sweep for snares, guns and dogs. And once again, he was very unsuccessful. They got beaten out as well. They did get a few, and a few people were indicted, and a couple were transported. But on the whole, there was a trial in 1685 concerning the squatters' rights, and the squatters were largely victorious. And that's the last that was heard about the actual squatters' rights for some time, until, there was other rights that I've spoken about before in Kingswood. There was food rights in 1709, 40 and 53. But the 1727 right was very interesting, because basically that was around a toll road that had fallen into disrepair. and the magistrates were trying to increase the tolls and also increase the tolls on the King's Woodians, bringing the coal in. And the King's Woodians said no on two counts. One was, as I already said, about bringing the coal in, but the other one was reminding the magistrates it was their duty to upkeep the road. And they hadn't done it. And they also pointed out, and there's quite a long letter there's quite a long letter, and it is in the library, actually, from the Kingswoodian colliers at the time. But it would suggest by the language used, it was probably written by someone who was very literate. I'm not being disrespectful to the colliers, but if they spend a large amount of their day down a hole in the ground, they're not likely to have a very good standard of written English. No disrespect. It was probably a lawyer or one of these landowners that got someone in to write this letter, putting out the customary rights. And they rounded up by saying, this toll road runs through the common. You've got plenty of stone and other goods on the common that you could utilise to repave this toll road, keep it up to scratch. And being perfectly frank, it was hurting their horses, and also their carts were getting worn down as well over a period of time due to the decline in this. And 1738, which is one of the last ones I'm going to speak about, there was a big wage dispute as well. And as a trade unionist, I also know this is one of the first organised wage disputes in this country. As I said, the players brought in, the players is one of the blokes who had the liberties, sorry. A local player brought in a master collier, and he decided to lower the wages. Of course, what happened to some of the other big collieries also felt that if they lowered the wages here, then their coal would be cheaper and they would undercut them in Bristol. So they started to lower the wages as well. All the colliers got together in mass, and apparently even the ones who had the little concerns, because they realised they would be undercut as well. And what they did is they went to the large colliery that had lowered the wages, got all the topside stuff like the pulleys and all that down the hole with it, and basically the wage reduction was taken off the table and the wages stayed the same as they had been. Unfortunately, what eventually happened, and this is part of my last speech as well, so I won't label on it too much, is that the civil authorities got really uppity about the Kingswood Common and the Kingswood Forest about the end of the Napoleonic War. Once again, there was large pushes and strains on the Bristol economy due to the end of the Napoleonic War. And I mean, Bristol was central to the war economy for shipbuilding, brass for the cannons, even uniform making. But with all the soldiers coming back and a decline of that economy as well, there was a large reserve pool of labour, if you like. Some of these were ending up in Kingswood, and there was a lot of, civil disobedience going on at the time. There was a large criminal gang operating out of Kingswood. You might have heard of the Cock Road Gang. You certainly have if you've heard me speak. Very interesting bunch. And once again, some of the families, the squatters' names going right back to 1508, the family names are still being indicted in 1810, 1815, right until 1817, in these collective riots and such likes. The Cock Road Gang were highly organised. They had they stole horses from a far afield as Hereford, right to London, Cheltenham, and then sold them at different fairs. They actually ran a protection racket round with some of the other medium-sized landowners, and the actual protection racket was worked out on the side of their holdings. So if you had a bigger farmland, you paid more, basically. Once again, I mean, it would suggest a bit about, self-organisation, but then again, it is going into the realms of gangsterism, really, isn't it? And what actually happened with the Cock Road Gang, and this is a very short synopsis, was a group called themselves the Kingswood Association. Well, the Methodists got in as well, don't forget. Wesley was up there for a little bit and converted a lot of people to Christianity. And in fact, the 1653 grain riots, some senior Methodists met some of the Kingswood colliers as they were coming into Bristol and talked a large amount of them out of actually going into Bristol and smashing the city up. And instead they took a petition to the mayor that was largely ignored. But the Kingswood Association were very, very, very active in forming a mini militia, and a mini civil war went on up there. And eventually what happened was a lot of the Cock Road Gang were arrested, taken away, transported, some were hung. There was one woman called Elizabeth Keynes who are husbands, and six of her seven boys were either hung or transported over this period of time of 1800 to 1820. And eventually, you saw running incrementally with that was the, concurrently with that, sorry, was enclosure acts. And some of the people that were involved in enclosing large swathes of the Kingswood Forest were also signatories to the Kingswood Association. And there was a big meeting in the 1820s in the Flower Pot in Kingswood that basically divided the land up. And it makes me laugh, in 1824, which is after the land's broken up, and there's a handbill about Sabbath breaking. I mean, when you think about the renownness of the forest before that as being a completely lawless area, that you certainly wouldn't go after dark if you were Bristolian. You know, and you're quite nervous getting to Bath, because that's something else about the Cock Road gangs. They're renowned for being highway people, because those who know the geographical lie there, there's a hill that looks over the Bath Road, and it lets you sit up there watching the passing traffic and seeing what they fancied. But this handbill in 1824, after the enclosure of large swathes, says, Sabbath breaking, the playing, gambling, cursing, swearing, or tumultuously or lewdly assembling in Kingswood Hill, and they could lock them up. I have to be honest, I don't know what else you'd be doing on a Sunday, but, you know, another really sad thing was the poor law came in, there was large amounts of people were put onto the poor law, and they had to actually wear a red patch that was very, very, you could see it on their body somewhere, so you knew they were in the seat of the poor law. And I believe personally it was a shame what the Kingswood Forest lost, because I think what we've all lost, because it was such a large part of the economy of the landless labourers and also the poor. I know there's other historians who say that if it wasn't for enclosure, we wouldn't have industrialisation. For example, the push-pull-fall factors of pushing landless labourers into the factory system and such likes. But also the improvement, the agricultural improvements as well. But I think the counter-argument of that, of the common land, is what it provided for so many people. For free as well. You know, going back to Ledall that I was talking about in Northamptonshire, he said that the forest commoners didn't use money. You know, somebody collected all the furs and they would swap it for this and that, and somebody else would have the berries. And a lot of things, as the name suggests, was held in common. There was quite, I mean, especially before Protestantism, with a large amount of Catholic festivals, you know, people would get together on a regular basis and consume and have fun together. And with the enclosures, a lot of these rites fell to the wayside and people could no longer access. And in fact, after Black Act, as I said earlier, you could actually get hung for taking wood and firing it up in your own fire and heating and making sure your children were warm enough to survive the winter. I think that's about all I'm going to say at the moment, but I'm well open for any questions.
Not several water.
Any questions? Thank you.
How does the law stand today on the one-day house? Does it still apply?
Oh, I mean, because it's not written down. I mean, should we go and do one? It would be interesting on Oldland, you know, on Oldland.
In St. Werburgh, where I live, there's a patch of land that's used by nobody. It's owned by the Hordings company.
Yeah.
That brought it off the bit of road, but roadside land that's been bought for pittance from the council like 20 years ago.
Mm.
And I just thought it would be perfect to build a really quick squatting building as a community space.
Absolutely.
I'd love to do it as well. And just challenge the status quo.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, this day and age as well, I mean, this society is suffering from homelessness. Badly, there's a lot of people that just cannot afford proper adequate housing.
I think it'd be fantastic to just have a go and see what happens. Even if they come and kick our heads in.
Not too sure about the last bit, but no, you're right. I mean, it'd be good if that came out of that. If perhaps some Bristol radical historians would like to just try that out. just try it out. Yeah, because it'd be far easier for that. Because that's something else. When you think about it, you've got to clear the land, and even if it's just a wooden and turf structure, you've still got to get it all there. You know, you've got to know what you're doing as well, and you've got to be doing it quickly. So there'd have to be an element of planning. There'd have to be a lot of cooperation.
but you could, I mean, you could fire it up and then improve it as the time went on. I'm not sure what they think about, where did you say it was, not suburbs?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what they think about us throwing axes about. We might have to get health and safety advice on that. I looked at my trade union comrades at the back. They don't look at that. Any other questions? Go on.
What was the first of the Kingswood Forest? I mean, we're, like, I know Eastern, for instance, is part of the Kingswood Forest, but do you know what abounds with?
The forest, I mean, down here it's got 3,400 acres, which is quite a large amount. Exactly, what does that actually mean? And before, I always go about Kingswood Forest as without Lawford's Gate, which is what the locals used to call it at the time. I'm talking about the 19th century. And Lawford's Gate is by the Gin Palace, the old market, by Trinity Road near. So anything out there. So that'd be Stapleton, St George, Hannum, right up to Bitton, Absom, right up to there. Right up to there. I mean, this is something else. It was something else that was very important about it, I forgot to mention. It was right on the border of Bristol, that was obviously a county, Somerset, and also Gloucester. So sometimes they would nip over the border, do something out of order, and then nip back again. And the authorities just wouldn't go into Kingswood. And you'd have some interaction between the different local governments, local authorities, who say they've done this, and they've gone, we'll go and get them. They're on your land, cut around the moment, no, you don't care. So literally like that, you know, don't know. But I mean, it was so important as well about the colour. You know, the Bristolians really didn't want to antagonise them. Because when there was riots, on the whole, the colliers picked the right time. They picked the time when the Bristolians needed the coal most, especially for heating. So you hit the wider populace, if you like. And also that time of year as well, you're less likely to be down holding the ground, aren't you? You know, the ground, you know, there's a whole host of different problems you've got with that, from heavy rainfall and snow, for example. Especially on the small holdings, when there's no pumps. And that was one of the reasons why the larger holdings got together, because there's pool in the resources. And also, it could be safer, if you like, you know, because in the little ones, it literally was just a hole in the ground. The Kingswood Forest is massive. But as an actual forest, it was in decline in the 15th century, shipbuilding. And also the miners as well, because then, I mean, the wood had been used for shoring as well, that's another very important one. You know, so as the mines went down, the trees come down. Yeah. I also know that in the 1670s, when those surveys were going on, the riots as well, there was something like 100 cattle but 500 horses on the Kingswood Chase. And most of those were pit owners. So that gives you also an idea of the extent of the mining going on there. Certainly not something I would fancy. Some of the records of some of the disasters that went on, people being buried alive at Basel Lead. I mean, some of them I spoke about at the last speech as well, where some people stuck down literally for 20 days. But also saying that the whole community got round and tried to get them out, was lowering food down and such like. And when they got them up, they didn't get all of them up, some of them died. But they ranged from, there was one little boy who was 10 who basically survived because he was quite nimble. But the eldest who survived was 70 odd. You know, I mean, even this day and age, it would be difficult at 70 years old to mine. I was, you know, it was a very hard, physical job. And they came up and the 70 odd had gone blind during his time down there. Affected them so much, and they were all quite affected. And apparently, they couldn't work down the mine again. But it was psychologically damaged. Some of them recognised it as stressful, like it's sort of now, different then. But they got together 25 quid, which in that day and age, I think it was the 1750s around that time, was a magnificent amount. You know, and these people would not have to work again. And they were, you know, there was a big party was held, and their survival was celebrated. You know, brilliant community. As long as you're not walking through every Monday.
I'll make a point that we met a miner on Monday.
Yeah.
73 in the Forest of Dean, so he's doing 2 miles.
Yeah.
So he was as tough as ever.
Yeah, I was very interested in the Forest of Dean as well, because their rights are more enshrined, aren't they? Yeah. But even then, about the same time that they were having to go at Cock Road, the 1810 to 1820s, Warren Dean, his well, it wasn't so much like that, there wasn't throwing down the fences and such like that. That was the 1820s as well, wasn't it?
Mm.
And once again, it seemed like it goes in stages where central government tries to reinforce what it sees as its rights over the Forest community. And thankfully, in the Forest Dean and St. Brevin's, I believe they still had it that night. So perhaps that was something else we could do, stop digging a hole in Kingswood.
Great!
He's got a shovel.
Not quite sure.
Nobody free on them.
Anything else, comrades? Well, I hope you've enjoyed yourself this afternoon. I certainly have. I must admit, a lot of respect to the Bristol Radical History Group, and especially Roger for what they've set up. I understand this is even going live on the internet, so I can keep in contact with all my friends in Botswana and further afield, which is handy. So I don't get to see them as much as I'd like. No, but fair play, Roger. Hard work, and let's hope it goes onwards and upwards, eh?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.